Lecture 11. Papal Ambition.
The tension between conciliarism that had ended the schism in the church and the principle of papal monarchy that had been established during the Middle Ages and had reached its apogee under Innocent III, who died in 1216, came into close relief with the election of Martin's successor, Eugene IV. These principles, these diametrically opposed principles of conciliarism and papal monarchy, were focused upon an individual who seemed to lack the diplomatic skills to get himself out of the crisis that to some extent had been suppressed by the need in the church to reestablish its position in Europe, that situation that had given a little bit of respite to Martin V. Eugene ran into difficulty almost from the beginning of his career. He was in fact forced to flee Rome briefly because of a popular uprising, and many of the princes of Europe began to use this tension between conciliarism and papal monarchy as an opportunity to reassert their authority over the jurisdiction of the church. And indeed, one of these princes realized that it would be very effective if, in fact, the schism could be sustained or reinstated, or if conciliarism could be put in place so that the papacy would remain weak and the church could then be brought under the control of secular rulers. This, after all, was the time of the creation of dynastic territorial monarchies, and the independent franchise of the church within these territorial monarchies always, to a degree, challenged the absolute power of the secular prince to rule as he saw fit. A council was called in order to depose Eugene, in fact, and an antipope was elected on the basis of conciliar theory, the antipope Felix V. Once more, it seemed as though the church would be divided and there would be again two popes, but this time, one ruling according to the theory of conciliarism, in which he was the elected officer of the entire church operating collectively, and the idea of papal monarchy represented by Eugene in Rome. Eugene never solved this problem altogether, and the antipope Felix V continued to rule while Eugene was alive. But with his death in 1447, there was elected a most remarkable man, Nicholas V Pentucelli. Nicholas V succeeded in restoring the dignity to the Holy See, and partly because of his own personal qualities, was able to end the schism that seemed to be growing once more. The antipope, Felix V, was convinced to resign, and there was once more a single papacy, a single pope who could rule over all of the church. And the issue of conciliarism didn't really raise its head under his pontificate, largely because of his very Irenic quality and his desire to do good. In many ways, Nicholas is one of the great Renaissance popes, inasmuch as he had spent much time in Florence, and he largely brought the Florentine Renaissance to the Holy City. He also made a decision that would change the nature, in fact, the nomenclature of the papacy to this day. The Lateran Palace attached to the Cathedral of Rome, the Church of St. John in Laterano, was in fact still uncomfortable. It still was in the process of being rebuilt after having been abandoned during the Babylonian captivity. But more importantly, it was the Cathedral of Rome. It was associated with the idea of the Pope as Bishop of Rome. Nicholas realized the authority of the papacy could be much reinforced by more closely connecting it to the memory of St. Peter as the vicar of Christ on earth. It was Nicholas then who moved the headquarters of the church from St. John Lateran to the Vatican, to that palace that had been built in the Middle Ages next to the Basilica of St. Peter, which recognized the burial place of the first pope and the apostle on whom Christ had decided to build his church. The creation then of the Vatican, the idea of connecting the papacy with the apostolic succession and connecting the papacy closely with the idea of Christ's charge to Peter, was that of Nicholas. And in many ways, it addressed the conciliar issue head-on without seeming in any way to have addressed it at all. Nicholas was a brilliant man, and he was a good man, and these two things together brought a good deal of security and stability to the papacy. He also said when he became pope that he had three ambitions. He wanted to be a good man, which he succeeded very much in doing. He wanted to restore learning, which again he succeeded in doing by establishing the Vatican Library and patronizing copyists and scholars who would add very much to the luster of the church. And then finally, to rebuild Rome, to turn it into an imperial as well as a papal city, to reflect this double authority that the Pope enjoyed. And in this, he was successful as well. And to some extent, the modern shape of Rome is just beginning to be seen in that papacy that lasted until 1455. Nicholas was succeeded by a number of men who in no way met his stature. They were men who added little to the glory either of the papacy or to Rome. Of these, the best known and to some extent one of the saddest examples was Pius II. Pius had been a great humanist and scholar, a great diplomat, a man of substantial personal quality. He had also been a conciliarist. He had been an ideological conciliarist through most of his career and indeed had functioned as a secretary to the antipope for a while. But when he was elected pope, all of those dreams evaporated and he saw the ambitions of papal monarchy as much more appropriate, not just to his new role, but to his ambitions. Because despite his learning and despite having overcome a really rather reprobate youth, he had written in his youth, in fact, a salacious novel of lust and infidelity, and he had sired a number of illegitimate children, all of whom he dutifully sent home to his father to raise. But he had overcome this, and he was focused on a single issue after his election to the See of St. Peter, and that was to try and overcome the humiliation of the loss of Constantinople to the Turks in 1453. This was to him the great Christian tragedy. It was the force that was going to challenge the church and to challenge, in fact, the rule of Western Europe. And he was right. And he also knew that it had to be addressed immediately and by all of the princes of Europe if it was ever to be successful. He called for a great crusade of Christian Europe against the Turks to reconquer the city that had been built by Constantine. However, in a sad moment in 1464, as he awaited the arrival of the fleets that would carry the crusaders to the Bosphorus, he died. And the fleets, in fact, had just begun to appear at that coastal city of Ancona at the time of the Pope's death, and they turned around and went home. There was no crusade, and of course Constantinople remained the capital of the Turks. In contrast, his successors had no great policy. They weren't driven by a great ambition to recover the lands of Christendom or to structure the church in a way to benefit the faithful and to the European mission. Rather, in fact, they saw the church as an instrument for their own advantage and the advantage of their families. And as the papacy ennobled some, it also cast others into a less than bright light. And here the example is probably Sixtus IV della Rovere. He was elected in 1471, and he had all of the attributes of becoming a great pope. He was learned, he was very civilized, he was a great patron of learning. He was a man who should, in fact, have lived up to the greatest opportunity that the papacy offered, to be a model, to be an example, to be a beacon that others could follow. Instead of that, what he did is that he used the authority of the papacy to benefit his own family. His nepotism, his desire to make the members of his family the rulers of other people's states, or give them the great church livings that would allow them to live in luxury and power forever, undid the great things that he actually did for the city. Sixtus IV, despite his policy of nepotism, was one of the kindest popes to Rome. He built the first bridge across the Tiber since antiquity, the Ponte Sisto. He re-established the Vatican Library and much enlarged it after Nicholas V's initial foundation. He established the Sistine Choir, which today still is the choir that surrounds the Pope for liturgical functions. And of course, he built the Sistine Chapel, which his nephew was to decorate with Michelangelo, and which he decorated on the walls with the greatest of all the Tuscan and Umbrian painters. However, it was his nepotism that indicated the danger in papal monarchy. The idea of the Pope as a prince, as a secular ruler, who had a family that had to be cared for, an opportunity to establish a princely line, these were just two great opportunities to simply pass by. And Sixtus, unfortunately, fell prey to them. It was he who attempted the assassination of Lorenzo de' Medici in Florence and did succeed in killing his brother through the instrument of the Pazzi conspiracy because he wanted to give his worthless nephew Girolamo Riario a state on the borders of Tuscany. He gave another worthless nephew, the Archbishopric of Florence, that rich see to give him authority. And all of these elements of nepotism reflected not so much the weakness and character of a man, but the tension and the internal contradiction in an office that was at once spiritual and secular. A priest king, a priest who had the authority to help the faithful achieve salvation, and a king who had all of the rule, all of the elements of secular rule at his command. And Sixtus IV succumbed. Innocent VIII, his successor in 1484, succumbed in other ways. Innocent was not ambitious for his family in the same way, because his family was much more intimate. He had a number of children, all of whom he not only recognized, but all of whom he married into the most powerful families of the Italian peninsula, including the Medici. He was immensely rich personally. He came from a great Sienese banking family. He had huge resources, so he wasn't interested in dispossessing others, but he was interested in living well. He was a man not of much spiritual development, not of much political ambition. What he wanted to do was to enjoy his family, to live in luxury, and to enjoy the see that God seemed to have given him. It was with Innocent VIII, to some extent, that the moral position of the papacy began to decline dramatically. Not only here was a pope who had children that he recognized publicly and that everyone knew to be his, but also a pope that seemed to take very little interest in the spiritual well-being of the faithful. He was not even a major patron of culture, despite being a pleasant and delightful companion. His one great contribution was his tomb, that of Pollaivolo, which was one of the few monuments brought from the old Basilica of St. Peter into the new, and which still graces the wall of that building to this day. If Innocent VIII began the moral slide of the papacy into a position of individual development of ambition and the exercise of pleasure and the exercise of arbitrary authority for the well-being of the Pope and his family rather than for the well-being of the Church, it was crystallized in Alexander VI Borgia. Alexander VI was a truly remarkable man. He was the richest cardinal probably that ever lived. He had been papal vice chancellor for so long that he got a skim from almost every office in the church that allowed him to, in effect, purchase the papacy in 1498. And once he had purchased the papacy, he had very clear plans for it. He also, like Innocent VIII, was not a man who even attempted to cover his personal failings. His longtime mistress, known as the Queen of Rome, Venozza Catanei, lived perfectly openly. Their four children together were not only recognized, but they were often entertained in the papal palace, and his daughter, Lucrezia Borgia, actually lived with them in the papal apartments, where no woman was supposed to be entertained at all. Alexander VI was an ambitious man, but not for himself, but for his children. He had already achieved his greatest ambition, the Holy See, and he wanted to use it as a platform in which to build a Borgia kingdom out of the states of the Church. In other words, those states that had initially been founded, that had been established in order to protect the independence of the Church from secular rule, Alexander saw as an instrument of secular rule to benefit the Borgia, and he was willing to sacrifice ecclesiastical power and spiritual authority in order to achieve these things. His eldest son, Juan, who was to be the initial instrument of this policy, was found murdered, floating in the Tiber, and the assassin was almost certainly his brother Cesare. Cesare Borgia had initially been put in the church in order to become a future pope. Cesare, one of the psychopaths of history, had no interest whatsoever in ecclesiastical living and assassinated his brother largely to get out of the sacred college. Cesare then became the captain general of the church and became the instrument by which a Borgia kingdom would be created. The circumstances, though, were not to allow this to happen, and with the death of the Pope in 1503, while Cesare himself was ill with malaria, There was then a collapse of Borgia power. The Borgias had overreached themselves, and they had tried to turn a spiritual power into a secular machine. And there still was not the opportunity to achieve this, and the Pope did not live long enough, and there were too many forces acting against the Borgia ambition. In particular, the election of the successor of Alexander VI indicated just why papal policy could not be sustained over long periods of time because of the elective nature of the office. And as in any office that is subject to changes in personality and changes in policy, the papacy was often seen as an instrument by which there could be protection for those who had been threatened by previous administrations. Despite a very brief reign of the elderly nephew of Pius III following the death of Alexander VI, the person most feared by the Borgia, their worst enemy, one who had to spend much of the Borgia pontificate in France, in exile, hiding from the Borgia wrath, was elected pope. This was the nephew of Sixtus IV, Giuliano della Rovere, who took the name of Julius II. He took the name of Julius because he wanted to be remembered as a successor of Julius Caesar, and because Alexander VI had, by reputation, chosen the name Alexander so he could be remembered like Alexander the Great. Julius II had no intention of sustaining Borgia policy, and moreover, he was not guilty of nepotism. His one illegitimate daughter was in no way favored. She was married into the great Orsini feudal family, but the Pope did not support her or her husband overmuch. The Pope was not guilty of nepotism. He was not guilty of family ambition for the Della Rovere, as his uncle had been. But he was ambitious for the papacy and the church, not so much as a spiritual entity, but as a political entity. And Julius II emerges from the succession of St. Peter as the warrior pope, the pope who preferred the smell of gunpowder to incense, the pope who liked to dress like a Roman emperor, wearing the yellow papal color as a cape around his armor, walking with common soldiers up to his waist in snow, well into his 60s. This was a man who saw himself as an emperor and as a prince. He was pope, he also was personally relatively pious, but he also was a person who stressed and who privileged the secular role of the papacy as the king element of the priest-king role of the successors of St. Peter. Julius' ambition was to once and for all destroy the power of the great Roman families, which he succeeded in doing, and also to unite the states of the church behind the papacy so that the states of the church could be passed down coherently from pope to pope to protect the independence of the church. Not, I think, from Julius' perspective, to protect the orthodoxy of the church and to protect the independence of a spiritual leader of a pope and to protect the papacy from conciliarism, although all of these certainly played a role. It was rather to allow the pope to function as a papal monarch, to be a true king, and to rule a state that rivaled the other great states of the Italian peninsula. Julius II was very successful during the period of his life in doing this, although he too came into conflict with the other powers that had challenged the Italians for rule of their own nation. The French and the Habsburgs had already entered the field, and Julius found himself playing one against the other in an attempt to ensure that the papacy would not be subject to the rule of the House of Valois or the House of Habsburg. And in this, he in fact had great foresight. But in this, he was not altogether successful. He was successful, though, in re-establishing the authority of the papacy as the great patron of art and culture. Julius II was a remarkable man. He was not only a soldier who loved battle and warfare, he was not only a very skilled administrator, but also he was one of the greatest patrons in the history of the West. He brought Michelangelo to paint the ceiling of his uncle's chapel, the Sistine. He brought Raphael to paint the papal apartments that today are known as the stanze of Raphael, those rooms that were to be ensured as a papal residence forever, in which the glory and majesty and taste and elegance and authority of Julius would be forever visible, kept, maintained, sustained by the greatest painter of his time, Raphael of Urbino. In 1513, Julius died, his work not completely done, his apartments not finished by Raphael, the ceiling of the Sistine completed by Michelangelo, but his tomb by that same artist is as yet incomplete. And he was succeeded by another pope who saw the advantage of patronage, who saw the advantage of the exercise of artistic and cultural authority as a way of giving grandeur to the papacy, as well as an immortality to the person who served as pope. And that was the second son of Lorenzo de' Medici, the Magnificent of Florence, Giovanni de' Medici, who took the title of Leo X. Leo was in so many ways an attractive man. He was young when he was elected pope, only 37. He was highly educated, extremely cultivated and civilized, elegant company, and one whose ambitions for the papacy were essentially good. He was, though, limited by, first of all, his own personality. When he was elected pope, he skipped from the conclave and said, "Now that God has given us the papacy, let's enjoy it." He did enjoy it, and he enjoyed it in ways from which we benefit today. He enjoyed it because he continued Raphael's work in the Stanze. He enjoyed it because he was a great patron of music, and he expanded the Sistine Choir and was a patron of composers to make sure that music would always be a fundamental part of the papal liturgy. He was a person who had Raphael make the great tapestries that are hung to this day for high liturgical events in the Sistine Chapel. Leo, then, was not a man that we should simply neglect, or a man that we should relegate to the failures of history because something happened during his reign that would ultimately split the church forever. He was a man who saw only too locally. He saw the world from his perspective and from his experience. When Martin Luther in 1517 challenged the authority of the papacy and its right to dispense on earth, when Martin focused the discontent of many faithful members of the German-Roman confession, when he focused the ambitions and the discontent of the princes of Germany, not just against the church, but also against the Holy Roman Emperor, he did it completely unintentionally. The Reformation was, to some extent, an unintentional consequence of a set of events that we can really trace back to the Babylonian captivity, in which the church was being challenged from within and without, where the whole issue of there being a single route to salvation was assaulted by those heterodox groups that had looked for a way around the problem that the Babylonian captivity, and in particular the Great Schism, had put in place. And it also recognized that other revolution happening in Europe, the creation of those dynastic territorial monarchies. Those princes that we've already seen playing papal authority against royal or princely authority, those princes who put their own ability to rule their own territory against the traditions of an independent ecclesiastical jurisdiction that had resulted in the French king in 1438 and the pragmatic sanction of Bourges getting virtual control over the church, or the Diet of Mainz the next year where the Habsburgs, where the Imperials largely controlled the German church. These things were part of a process that, to a degree, reached completion and was fulfilled by Martin Luther. Luther then crystallized a series of events that happened not just in Rome, but right across the continent. And it was Leo X who had the misfortune of serving as a successor to St. Peter when it happened. Leo completely underestimated the Lutheran revolt. He initially thought it was just another argument among monks, Augustinians against Dominicans. He didn't see that, in fact, what was being discussed, not metaphorically, but in the reality of political and religious terms, was an assault on the very idea of papal monarchy and the very concept of a singular church ruled by a priest king who was the successor to that Peter on whom Christ built his church. Leo, not recognizing this, allowed it to fester, and moreover, the political divisions in the German Empire and the hostility to the ambitions of the Emperor Charles V in particular allowed German princes to see this as an opportunity to fulfill something that they had often wanted to do, take possession of the property of the church and take possession of the jurisdiction of canon law and ecclesiastical authority that had always been outside their control, despite the growing authority that they were beginning to wield over ecclesiastical jurisdictions. Leo then was not a successful pope, despite his ability to create beauty and despite the charm that he exercised on everyone. He also was not very nepotistic. He did, in fact, fight a war in Urbino that took the ruler out of his palace to be replaced by the nephew of the pope. But that didn't last, and it was a singular event. It was something that he had to do to find a job for his rather worthless nephew, who needed a principality because, after all, he was a Medici as well as being the nephew of the pope. It was after the death of Leo that the crisis truly came, that what was festering in Europe and dividing the continent had been focused very much not just on the church and on Rome, but also on the Italian peninsula. The events that had changed Europe so dramatically that were altering the culture and the dynamic of an entire continent became focused on the Italian peninsula because that is where the issue would be determined. And to some extent, that is where the ideological division was being discussed. It was the cousin of Leo X, Clement VII de' Medici, who had to face the crisis. In 1525, the French king, Francis I, was humiliated at the Battle of Pavia by the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V of Habsburg. The French king was a prisoner in Spain, and Charles seemed to be reigning supreme. Charles, though, after this victory, allowed his army in the peninsula to languish, an army that was led by a French traitor, the first cousin to the French king who had gone over to the Habsburgs because he had quarreled with Francis's mother over money. Again, another administrative and political observation that seems to be recurrent in human history. The Constable of Bourbon, unable to control this professional army of Spanish veterans and Lutheran German pikemen, followed the army as it ravaged its way through the peninsula until ultimately, in the spring of 1527, it stood before the gates of Rome. The gates were breached, the wall was breached, and the city was sacked over the next 8 months in the most horrific way imaginable. The sack of Rome was one of the most horrific events in all of Western European history. It was a terrible moment. It not only destroyed that humanist Renaissance belief in human dignity, but it also destroyed the idea of the Pope as a successor of St. Peter, who is omnipotent on earth and in heaven. The Pope was humiliated. Clement VII was forced to flee from the Vatican Palace to seek some measure of protection in Castel Sant'Angelo. And it was from the ramparts of that castle, originally built as a tomb of the Emperor Hadrian, that he watched the city being destroyed by a new barbarian invasion over which he could do nothing. The sack of Rome of 1527 was seen by the Lutherans as God's righteous anger. The Antichrist had been chastised. It was seen by Catholics as evidence that God had somehow abandoned Europe. And we have to remember that there's a context much broader than Europe. We have to remember that the context of these events must be seen much more broadly than the Italian peninsula or even Europe itself. It was, after all, 1527, just months after the Battle of Mohacs, where the Christian army led by the King of Hungary had been slaughtered by Suleiman the Magnificent and the Turks. It was just months before the Siege of Vienna of 1529, which seemed to threaten the entirety of Christian Europe at the hands of the infidel, the Turks. It appeared the apocalypse was at hand, and God was angry with Christianity and angry with Europe. Of course, there was no apocalypse, and indeed, this crisis brought forth the ability of the papacy to restructure and redefine itself. In 1534, a new pope was elected, a pope who was a Roman noble, and the Farnese Pope, Paul III, called the Council of Trent in order to restructure and revitalize the church. This council was not an act of conciliarism because it was summoned by the Pope. In fact, it was almost an act of anti-conciliarism, making the council dependent upon the authority of the Pope himself. The council met between 1545 and 1563, and it redefined not just the faith, but specifically addressed the sorts of issues that the Protestants had used to assault the position of Roman Christianity, but from it emerged the idea of papal monarchy in all of its glory. The Council of Trent recognized that in this war with the Protestants, there had to be just one general and one leader, and that was the Pope. Trent then not only reformed the church, but gave a new authority to the position of the Pope. The Pope emerged more powerful than ever, and the church more glorious than ever, because the council also recognized the need for glory and beauty and power and authority that would overwhelm the senses. The age of the Baroque had been born.